The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
Our kids have said to us since we moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, the values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Hi, I'm Ethan Nadelman, and this is Psychoactive, a production of iHeartRadio and Protozoa Pictures. Psychoactive is the show where we talk about all things drugs. But any views expressed here do not represent those of iHeartMedia, Protozoa Pictures, or their executives and employees. Indeed, as an inveterate contrarian, I can tell you they may not even represent my own. And nothing contained in this show should be used as medical advice or encouragement to use any type of drugs. Hello, psychoactive listeners. Well, before I introduce today's guest, I just want to bring you up to date on a little actually disappointing news for me, which is that this first version of Psychoactive will unfortunately come to an end in late January when we complete two seasons. And I have to say, I mean, basically what's happened is that the two key backers of Psychoactive, which is iHeart and Darren Aronofsky's company Protozoa, have made a wonderful investment in this. And the audience has been growing. The reviews have been fantastic. But unfortunately, and I understand this and empathize with it, the numbers of listeners is not yet significant enough to justify a continuing investment. So we'll likely be taking a break at the end of January and trying to figure out how to bring Psychoactive back in some similar but slightly different form with different backers. So at this point, what I'd like to say to you is that if you've been enjoying the podcast, please post your comments, put them up on, you know, whether it's Apple or Spotify or iHeart or Google, wherever you listen to your podcast. So I hope to keep Psychoactive going into the future. I really love doing it and I've gotten wonderful feedback. But part of its future will depend upon you, the listeners, and how much you can, you know, not just send your positive feedback, but spread the word. Encourage others, peers, friends, students, teachers, whatever, to listen so that we can build this audience as big as possible. Okay, well, that said, let me introduce today's guest. He's Professor Neil Carrier. He's a professor of social anthropology at the University of Bristol in the United Kingdom. And he is one of the really leading experts in the world, both about drugs in Africa and more specifically about a drug called KHAT, spelled K-H-A-T or Q-A-T. And I'm delighted to have him on Psychoactive today. So, Neil, thanks so much for joining me and my listeners on Psychoactive.
Our pleasure, Ethan. And yeah, thank you very much for having me on the podcast.
So now I realize that many of you may never have heard of KHAT. I mean, I've been fascinated by it because I've been studying drugs for many decades. And it doesn't pop up much in the news in the United States. And occasionally you read about a bust by the DEA or local authorities, typically directed at Somali or Ethiopian immigrant communities living in the United States, or maybe at a transshipment that gets caught at a port. But it's got a long and rich history. And I want to discuss with Neil today both not just about Cott and its unusual history, but also how thinking about Cott in relationship to other drugs like coffee, like tobacco, like coca, like opium, like even kava. I mean, how we think about these drugs comparatively in terms of their indigenous uses, in terms of their modernization, in terms of international markets and all of that. So, Neil, why don't we just start off, if you could explain to our listeners, what exactly is Cott? What does it come from? What does it do? How far back does it does its history go? Start us off with answers to those questions.
Oh, sure. Thank you, Ethan. Yes, well, basically, cat comes from either a shrub or a tree. Cat comes from the Cattaria julis plant, which can grow as quite a small shrub or can grow into something quite a bit larger, into a full-blown tree, depending on how it is produced and cultivated. And basically, it is the product that is sold are the young stems and leaves that shoot up from the main branches of the shrub or the tree. And these have stimulating properties, mainly due to some compounds that resemble amphetamine in how they work on the central nervous system.
Those compounds are cathinone and caffeine. Those are the two key elements. And cathinone is basically a sort of cousin of amphetamine with somewhat similar effects.
That's right. And it's quite interesting. I think pharmacologically, there has been quite a bit of work done on all the different types of compounds. So, as you know, with a lot of these plants, including cannabis and the like, people tend to focus on particular compounds, THC or what have you. And it's quite similar with cat as well. So a lot of the focus pharmacologically is on this substance, cavinone. But there are a lot of other compounds within cat that, have been researched in more or less detail. But basically, it is these leaves and stems are consumed by chewing, and people build up a wad of cat in their cheeks and chew often for quite a few hours at least for a time, constantly building up this wad in the cheek. So maybe a little bit like chewing tobacco or chewing coca. So mm-hmm. This wad is constantly replenished. And this is what releases the stimulating properties of the substance.
Mm-hmm. So similar in the same way that, say, indigenous peoples of Bolivia, Peru, Colombia, elsewhere will chew the coca leaf and slowly a slow drip of cocaine gets released. Or in some cases, people will chew tobacco and the nicotine gets released. Similarly, people will be chewing the cot and the cathinone and eventually the caffeine will get released. And that's what provides the pleasant feeling, I guess, of engaging in this.
That's right. And I think it's key, like the way it's consumed is quite a key aspect of cat, like with coca and chewing coca, because it is that, as you put it, a more measured release rather than taking a pure compound in one go. It's kind of released over the hours of a chewing session, which is a more gentle effect, really, than would be, say, taking the isolated cavinone. A friend of mine actually had a really, really nice way of explaining describing the effects of cat as being something that if you sit down in an armchair and you're not quite comfortable, but then suddenly you just shift your body and you find that place where, you know, your body's completely comfortable. Cat seems to be a little bit like that. It is quite a subtle effect, you know, the way mm-hmm. it makes you feel. But it is quite a pleasant substance.
And the history, I mean, does this go back millennia? Does it go back 1,000 years? Does it have a history similar to coffee or to opium? Or what would you compare it to?
Well, it does go back a long time. I think in records, it's probably about one millennium where we have records, especially in the region of Ethiopia and Yemen. There's a lot of early records, sort of textual records from that kind of region. And it's similar to coffee, actually. So probably about a similar timeline to coffee.
Mm-hmm. And associated, I mean, coffee is associated, you know, part of it is both the frisky goat story of realizing that this thing could wake you up in the morning and also then beginning to use it in order to help staying awake for the early morning prayers in Islam. Is there something similar? I mean, is cot more associated with Muslims than with Christians or animist or other types of religions?
Oh, it very much is. And sometimes there's an explanation given that for Muslim people without with restrictions on alcohol, that something like CAC can kind of fulfill that social role that alcohol does for many other societies. So there is that kind of argument, but it does link with especially forms of Islam, again, kind of more in the Ethiopian region. There are links with all-night prayer sessions in Sufi Islam. And in northern Kenya, where I've done quite a bit of work, you do get its consumption associated with things like spirit possession sessions, which do tend to involve kind of all-night sessions. So CAT, you know, something, there is like a functional aspect to it, you know, something that's quite useful for keeping people going in these kind of religious settings.
Mm-hmm. But it's not psychedelic in the sense of people using peyote or using iboga or things like that, right? People aren't hallucinating under the influence of this. They're more getting into a slightly modified state of consciousness.
That's right. I mean, it's not a direct psychedelic in that way. I think like a lot of these things, and the way context plays a role on how the effects are felt, though, you know, perhaps in those kind of consumption contexts, it might have a, you know, be able to generate some sorts of altered states, you know, along with like the kind of music that would be going on, the drumming, this kind of thing. So context can maybe give it a slight effect like that. But generally, no, it is a fairly gentle form of amphetamine.
Now, Neil, if we look in at the current time, I mean, if you look in the countries in the Horn of Africa, as well as in the emigre communities throughout the world, I mean, how many people are probably chewing cot on any one day? I mean, today, are there probably 10 million or 5 million or 25 million people in the world chewing cot? And is it overwhelmingly in Yemen and then in Somalia and Kenya? How does it break out?
To be honest, there really isn't the evidence yet to state with precision, I think, how many people would be consuming over any one day. But it's certainly consumed over a vast area. So all the way from Yemen, like you say, all the way actually down to the Eastern Cape in Southern Africa, you do get cat growing wild all the way down that region. So even in the Eastern Cape, there's people who do consume it, and it's also imported into South Africa from places like Kenya, and mm-hmm. Madagascar as well. Actually, is a place principally with the influence of Yemenis who settled in northern Madagascar centuries ago. But northern Madagascar as well is another place where quite a bit of cat is consumed. Mm-hmm. But the other sections of society where it's very, very, very popular, it's become very popular principally again for this more functional use by people like truck drivers, people like night watchmen, even students studying for exams. And culturally as well, it's become quite associated in places like Kenya with quite a youth culture, so very, very popular amongst a few youth as well. So it kind of cuts across a lot of different social categories in mm-hmm. in a place like Kenya.
And in most of these countries, primarily used still by men and relatively infrequently by women?
Generally speaking, that does seem to be the case. But there is consumption by women. And again, the proportions are probably higher in places like Yemen, Djibouti, places like this, and in somewhere like Kenya, where mostly it's seen as more a male pursuit.
Mm-hmm. And listen, for those listeners who have a poor sense of geography, it's useful to pull out a map at some point. But basically, the Horn of Africa is that kind of northeastern part of Africa, sort of below Egypt and Sudan, and then sort of running down the eastern side of Africa, and then just directly across from Yemen and Saudi Arabia. And in fact, the use even extends into the neighboring regions of Saudi Arabia as well, as I realized when I was doing the research on on this. But, you know, if you think about it, I mean, Yemen's got a population of 30 million. But if consumption there, I mean, that could be what, I mean, that's probably where the highest percentage of the population lives. So it's quite likely you have many, many millions of people, you know, in Yemen. Somalia's got 16 million people. So presumably you got a few million there. Kenya's got 53 million population. So even a small percentage there is going to add up. And Ethiopia, you know, is the second most populous country in Africa after Nigeria, over 100 million people. So I'm guessing that it must be in the tens of millions in addition to the emigre communities living in Europe and Australia and the UK, Canada, and elsewhere around the world. I mean, does that seem like a reasonable estimate?
That seems like a really, really reasonable way to estimate it. And I think the other sense of the scale is how much production has boomed in places like Ethiopia and Kenya as well, even moving beyond kind of traditional communities that were associated with its consumption and moving beyond places where it was usually associated as an item of cultivation as well. So I think from that, you can certainly get a sense of growing numbers of people chewing cat, because, you know, there wouldn't be this real growth in cultivation and trade if it weren't for increasing demand alongside that.
I see. And so the problem you have, and there's most of it then, is growing in Kenya and growing in Ethiopia. Does that mean that Yemen and Somalia and some of the other places are mostly importing this stuff that they chew?
Somalia mostly imports, but Yemen does produce a lot of its own cat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, one interesting thing about cat is that the key ingredient, right, the cathinone, you know, what the equivalent to cocaine in coca or THC in cannabis, it actually degrades very quickly once the leaves are picked. And I saw one of the articles I think you wrote was called The Need for Speed. So just talk about that and the implications of that.
That's right. Well, it very much does have a real implications for the way the trade is conducted in cat, and especially in terms of the transportation. So as you say, cathinone is generally thought of as degrading quite rapidly into this other compound, the cadine, which is a lot less potent. So there is this idea that because of this, consumers really do want to get their cat as fresh as possible to consume and get the most effects from the substance. I think that needs to be nuanced a little bit, because I think a lot of the reason why consumers prefer fresh cat is it just is much more pleasant to chew, you know, rather than cat that's dried a little bit as well. And I think some research shows that it's this compound, it can be more or less stable in some varieties of cat as well. So it's, I think, quite interesting pharmacologically there. But there's certainly this idea that there's this need for speed, you know, that there is this sense that people want the freshest cat possible. And the implications in places like Kenya really are very much about how fast the trade has to operate. Because especially where it's produced in Kenya is a region called Meru County, which is just northeast of Mount Kenya. And this is where most of the Kenyan crop of cat is grown. And it's notorious if you're driving anywhere in that region that you'll be driving along and suddenly you'll be pushed off a road by some speeding truck with sacks of cat. And this is quite a common idea, quite a common trope about the cat business, not just in Kenya but throughout, you know, in Ethiopia as well, these kind of trucks that speed on by, and basically that is to try and meet schedules, especially nowadays in Kenya with the trade, the export of Kenyan cat to Somalia. So that cat has to reach the airports in Nairobi very, very quickly, you know, to then be able to be loaded up onto planes to get to Somalia. So any delays in that process really can lead to an unsellable batch of cat.
Well, so let me ask you this, though, because one of the news items I came across was a major bust. It was in Seattle. And the, you know, customs authorities seized, I think, 10 tons of cot on a boat coming into the Seattle port. You know, I mean, sending it by boat. So how does the stuff stay at all good if it's been on a boat coming from East Africa into Seattle?
Well, it's a very interesting development that links to what's happened in the UK as well, where I'm based. And the UK, as you probably are aware, finally banned a cat in 2014. So the UK was one of the last European countries to bring about a ban on cat. And what you did find happened after the ban. So before the ban, tons of fresh cat was coming from Kenya, mostly from Kenya, some from Ethiopia as well, practically daily, coming into Heathrow Airport to then feed, you know, the wider demand in the UK. So this fresh cat was coming in vast quantities. But what seems to have happened since the ban is that there has been a shift to a dried form of cat. It's called Graba. Seems to be the name that a lot of people know it by in the UK and elsewhere. And it's quite interesting with these ideas about its pharmacology, about how unstable cavinone seems to be. Yet consumers still seem to say, or consumers that I've spoken to who have tried this dried cat, they still seem to suggest that it is actually quite potent. And to be honest, the pharmacological research I don't think has been done yet to really see what's going on there.
We'll be talking more after we hear this ad.
Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, the Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Classes in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, berry lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
When it comes to financial advice, you gotta trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. If you're looking to upgrade your wallet, you need to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. If you're paying for vacations with whatever card is in your wallet, you could be missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. You can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet. Finance smarter.
So yeah, I came across a funny story, I mean, and this may have been before this Graba version you're talking about came around, but it involves somebody getting busted some years ago in the U.S., but the person who arrested him sort of took their time in processing it, and so the person who'd gotten busted with the cat said he wanted to have it chemically analyzed. And what had happened was that the cathinone in the cat had already degraded to the point that it was no longer testing positive for that. And so if it had still been testing positive, he would have been busted for, you know, selling or importing a drug that was essentially a Schedule I drug in the United States, you know, like heroin or psychedelics or a range of other things. But because the cathinone had degraded, it was now just the caffeine, which is only a Schedule IV substance. So therefore, I think he almost just got off with a slap on the wrist. So I wonder if that's going to change now with this new Graba you're talking about.
Quite possibly, but it's there still is demand for the fresh cats, and it kind of links again to that need for speed, sort of pulling it out a little bit more broadly as well, with even like the Drug Enforcement Administration officers and customs agents in places like the US, you know, being told like if you do get a seizure of cat, you've got to get it to the lab for testing as quickly as possible. Otherwise, you know, the like you say, cavin owner schedule one substance, it will degrade into this cavin, so it would be a lesser charge as well. And not so good for statistics, I think, for kind of customs agents or the DEA well, in terms of, you know, if you can say, it's a really interesting story that perhaps we can get onto in a little bit about the criminalization of cat around the world and the scheduling of it.
Let's jump into that now. I mean, because I think, you know, for people to understand, I mean, I don't think cat's part of the UN conventions. I mean, you know, the UN agencies haven't been particularly friendly, and it's not something that's been criminalized since the early 20th century. I mean, the criminalizations that have happened around the world have been mostly in the, you know, the late 20th century or early 21st century, right?
That's right. So with cat, the compounds on it are actually scheduled. So cavinone and cavin, again, these are compounds that are scheduled according to the conventions. But then there was a lot of leeway given as to whether the plant itself would then also be regarded as kind of scheduled because of the compounds. So different countries took different approaches to that. So, for example, the UK for many years, so the isolated cavinone or cavin would be restricted compounds, but cat itself in plant form was not restricted. Whereas the US seems to have gone down a different route, because cavinone and cavin were themselves scheduled, that the US took the measure of assuming that because of that, that the United Nations intended that cat itself, if it contained cavinone or if it contained cavin, should also be restricted on those grounds. But there was no scheduling of cat itself. So this did lead to a lot of quite interesting international situations in regard to the legality of cat.
Mm-hmm. Well, so when we look at the criminalizations that happen, right, it is these European countries and the US and other, I guess, that begin criminalizing, but it actually goes back deeper than that, right? Because when you look, I mean, back to the colonial era in Africa, when the colonial overlords, you know, were concerned and would try to ban it. And it also goes, this is also an interesting case where this wasn't just Western elites banning something that they feared coming from abroad. A lot of the impetus in many places, both in the region as well as in Europe and maybe Canada or other places, seemed to be coming from people within the Somali community or from some of the immigrant communities. They were sort of playing out, if I understand what I've been reading from you and others, playing out, you know, this their own debate over how to look at cat.
That's right. It's and I think the terms that come out a lot in the way people write about cat, terms like ambivalence, terms like ambiguity, because there does tend to be so much ambivalence within particular communities about the consumption of cat. But certainly lots and lots of debates within Islam about whether cat is forbidden or permitted, whether it should be seen as forbidden as haram or whether it could be seen as halal. So these debates, there's actually quite a long tradition especially in Yemen, of debates around cat and the kind of the way Muslim scholars might view it, whether as permitted or not. You know, some seeing it as kind of, you know, so you can consume it as long as it's not harming your day-to-day life or your link to your community, whereas others are much more restrictive on its consumption. And then, kind of a lot of concern, especially often quite gendered forms of concerns as well, about the idea of cat as this very male pastime, where maybe taking the men away for long periods from the domestic sphere and contributing to the home, and the idea of spending too much money on this substance as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, it reminds me a bit because we've recently did an episode about the history of alcohol prohibition in the U.S. And there, that was very much a women's led movement as well to bring on, who led the temperance movement and then alcohol prohibition in the U.S. It was the same concerns around men spending their money on booze and not taking care of their families and claimed, associations with violence and reckless behavior and all this. And I think you would have some of the same debates around opium in many traditionally opium using communities with the female heads of household upset with what their husbands were doing and the waste of money going on. And then, of course, I think there's also sometimes the class-based conflict, right, with the elites kind of looking down their nose at the more working class folks, and obviously the concern around young people getting into it. I mean, it seems like some of those debates that I read about in your writings, are around the debates around what to do about COT are very similar to ones we've seen elsewhere around the world around other substances.
Oh, very, very much so. A lot of parallels throughout those as well. Within Kenya, one thing I became particularly fascinated by was all the different varieties of cat that are sold. And you do get cat being sold in Kenya for all sorts of pockets. You get the very expensive varieties of cat that come from the oldest trees, kind of like with vineyards, like the best quality grapes coming from the oldest vines. And it's a very, very similar discourse about the best quality cat coming from the oldest trees. And this sort of cat can really fetch quite a large amount of money. But then you do get lesser varieties as well, which are the equivalent of the maybe like the sweepings of tea from the factory floor that might be sold as, kind of low quality tea. So it was quite interesting always in Kenya, those divisions around class. So a lot of the Kenyan middle classes would often conflate all cat consumers as perhaps being quite lowly people, people working on the buses or in public transport or these kind of things. Whereas for those in the know, cat, it does straddle a lot of different class groups as well. So for those with insider knowledge about all these different types of varieties, you can see people who are buying a particular variety that is very, very expensive compared to, someone who might just be buying the cheapest quality as well.
Mm-hmm. Cat is not really criminalized in Europe, US, much of the world until the 80s. And then, as I understand it, what happens is, Somalia is falling apart into a horrific civil war. Somalians are emigrating around the world, including to throughout Europe, the U.S. They're bringing the COT tradition with them. And, the Western governments don't really quite know how to respond at first. But my understanding is that part of what drives many of them in Scandinavia, the U.K., probably some other countries, is that you have Somali emigres, refugees, themselves pushing for the prohibition in these European and other Western countries, while others are saying, what are you doing? This is our indigenous product. This is something that's native to, our cultures.
That's right. And it was quite a pronounced aspect of all the debates in the UK leading up to the ban in 2014. And it is very, very interesting, actually, how it does link to those kind of diaspora, those kind of emigre dynamics as well. One kind of critical aspect of all this is a sense among some Somalis that cat wasn't really an issue back in the home regions, but it's when it was displaced into the diaspora, the emigre kind of context that it became a problem. Partly the argument that, there were more kind of cultural restraints around consumption in the home areas compared to the diaspora context, the emigre context. But also one kind of quite interesting dynamic is the real sense of strong morality that a lot of Somalis have in the emigre context, that if you do get the if you do get the chance to live in somewhere like London or Minneapolis or these kind of places, that you should keep on supporting families back in the home regions. So there's a lot of remittances that are sent back from Somalis in the emigre context back to Somalia, to Somalis in Kenya and elsewhere. And I think with Kat, there's quite a strong morality about it that, you know, if you get the chance to be in somewhere like London, you know, a place where you could perhaps earn money, some of which could go back to supporting family, but instead you kind of waste it chewing cat in London or wherever. There was kind of a very, very strong sort of ethical pushback against that.
But all of that debate had its roots in similar debates going on in Yemen and in Kenya and Ethiopia and elsewhere, right? Because even there you had issues about, oh, this is not good, and the men are just hanging around and they're spending money on cot instead of food and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? I mean, it wasn't like these debates suddenly emerged when people got to Europe or to the U.S. It's just that they became, I think, probably more exaggerated because they were dealing with a new cultural context and all the more worried about their kids and about employment.
Definitely it's something that became intensified, like you say. These debates have been going on for a long time, and debates not necessarily about the individual consumer as well, but about, you know, kind of the idea of whole countries as well, you know, very economistic kind of way of looking at life, like, you know, wasting working hours by chewing this substance. Or so you often, the way places like Djibouti and Yemen might be written about, like as if a whole society was kind of addicted to this substance, and not, you know, the countries weren't developing as well as they might. You know, if only people stopped chewing cat, then, you know, development would come in a more concrete kind of form.
And the same thing was true in the colonial era, right, where the colonial overseers tried to ban it at certain times, or ban it for certain groups and not others, or try to license it, or all this kind of thing.
That's right. And so some of my research as well, more historical kind of archival research I've done, was looking at, again, at the Kenyan context, which is the one I'm still most familiar with. But it was, yeah, very, very interesting colonial story about the attempts to prohibit this substance. And again, you can see from quite early on in the archives, you know, going back to around the 1920s, 1930s, when the British authorities in Kenya, the British colonial authorities, suddenly realized how much cat was being consumed, how much was being grown, and how much was being traded. Because it suddenly came into their sight as, you know, a substance of interest. They hadn't really tracked it, and then all of a sudden they realised that this substance, from places like the Meru region of Kenya, it was travelling quite large distances and being sold, you know, as far away as Mombasa and places like this. And there were all these debates. So again, this idea of kind of ambivalence towards it and the ambiguities around it. So quite a few British officials didn't really see it being too problematic, or, you know, they were kind of comparing it to things like tobacco, and in moderation, it's not too bad a thing. But certain colonial officers really got a bee in their bonnet, really became quite involved in wanting to prohibit the substance, especially for certain parts of Kenya, like northern Kenya. There's a lot of concern that its consumption there was growing, and it really was affecting a region that was quite a sensitive region as well politically, because it was a buffer zone between Kenya and Ethiopia and Italian Somaliland as it then was.
Yeah, I got a kick out of, at one point you mentioned that, you know, the British didn't want to kind of get too tough on the Meru Kenyans because they respected them and it was a dynamic part of their culture. But with respect to the Somalis who were living in Kenya, if they wanted to get their cot, at one point they had a licensing scheme where they had to register as addicts in order to get access to cot. I mean, not unlike you had with some of the opium control systems in parts of Southeast and Southwest Asia at a roughly similar period in time, which is kind of humiliating to say, well, if you're Somali origin, you got to register an addict. If you're not Somali origin, then we're just going to tolerate it and, you know, either have it be legal or look the other way.
That's right. And it was quite racialized, the idea that these sort of pastoralist people of northern Kenya, like Somalis, that consumption by them was something quite problematic. Whereas for these agricultural people like the Meru, you know, it wasn't so seen as so problematic. So it was quite interesting how it became quite racialized, these kind of concerns about it by the British. But yes, it did lead to incredible situations where you did have people to go and get their supply of cat. At one point they would go and register with the district commissioner's office to go and get their supply. And I think quite a few people did did take on the kind of the label of being an addict, because then you did get a supply of cat given to you by the British district officers as well.
So at this point now, it's fully legal, right? In Ethiopia, in Yemen, in Kenya, in Djibouti?
That's right, yes.
And is it fully legal anywhere else?
In different countries, you can get quite a lot of legal ambiguities around it. So in somewhere like Uganda, where there is quite a growing consumption of cat and cultivation of cat as well, but I think different districts in Uganda do have like local kind of local laws kind of restricting cat as well. And in some places, it's never quite clear, you know, some like, for example, Madagascar, it's often written about as being illegal, but then also seems to be written about as being legal. And it can be quite hard to cut through the haze of this, because one thing with cat is it does get so much legal ambiguity built up around it. So even in somewhere like Kenya, where it is perfectly legal, but quite a lot of people see it as, you know, something to be regarded with suspicion and something quite dubious in many ways. So it does still takes on kind of an air of being something that, even if it can be sold openly, but there's something not quite right there. There's the other thing it became conflated with in the post 9/11 era with the war on terrorism as well. But there was quite a bit of push in the US especially, that cat trading routes should be properly policed, because there's this idea that the likes of Al Qaeda and so forth and Islamic militant groups in Somalia, were a lot of their funding was coming from cat. This was the idea anyway.
Well, there was probably some truth to it, right? I mean, it makes sense that groups that are involved in transnational criminality are looking to raise money any which way they can, that they're going to be getting some of their revenue from illicit drug sales. I mean, it's been true of most guerrilla movements, but many guerrilla movements, and I think most, you know, terrorist organizations that, you know, have a constant need for capital and that are constantly involved in, you know, trying to, you know, get guns from one place and then use the same planes to ship back drugs on the other. I think about the histories by Alfred J. McCoy about the politics of heroin in Southeast Asia, where he basically traces a lot of this history. So it would make sense that some of that was going on, although no doubt it was being exaggerated in the Western media.
Yes. What you would find, I mean, certainly I think Al Qaeda had no, as far as I'm aware, any no links to cat. But you certainly do find like groups like Al-Shabaab, kind of militia group, militant group in control of still quite large swathes of Somalia, that because cat is still sold, they sometimes do try and ban it. Because these kind of militant Islam groups like Al-Shabaab, often do see cat as something, you know, that should be forbidden. So sometimes there are attempts to ban it, but mostly, you know, they do kind of tolerate it. And it is the case that for a lot of these groups, because cat is being sold in that area, it is something that they tax. And so, you know, quite a bit of revenue is made for them. But then everything's taxed, you know, like all commodities like sugar, mm-hmm. charcoal. So anything going through these kind of regions. Mm-hmm. But I think quite a bit of that concern, especially things I read in the US, coming out of the US maybe around 2004, 2005, that kind of era. A lot of the concerns about cat and funding terrorism really did seem to be based on very, very little evidence. It was more more the case like, you know, cat is being sold all over the world. You know, it's a popular commodity. It seems to be a drug, and it's mostly associated with Muslims. We don't know where the money is going from cat. Therefore, there's a high likelihood it's funding Al Qaeda. And it seemed some quite tenuous logic was going on in this kind of exaggeration.
Right. So people just weaving it into the kind of narco-terrorism war on drugs narrative that they would apply with cocaine. And actually never really got attached to marijuana very much. Now, in terms of the enforcement in the emigre communities, I don't know if it was in your writings or in others where, you know, I was reading that in places like Scandinavia, it actually got pretty tough. I mean, they weren't just doing a blind eye to this stuff. They were using informants and random stops and arrests. I mean, there actually are some significant numbers of people, you know, Somalians, others who have been getting arrested and going to jail, at least. Is that right? Or is it really still just slap on the wrist type thing?
It very, very much does depend on the context. So it's very interesting to look at somewhere like the UK in relation to CAT, where, like I say, it was finally banned in 2014. But the ban, the way it's been enforced, they kind of have a free strike system where, first off, you just get a warning. Next time, maybe a fine. And then finally, there might be more proceedings kind of brought against you. Again, I think it'd be interesting to do some research on how many people are actually getting busted with CAT. But my sense anyway is that it's very, very low down any priorities for police forces, you know, whose funding is generally quite marginal at the best of time.
But at the same time, you had media. I saw it came across one thing like back in 2004, a relatively respected newspaper like The Guardian ran a piece with a headline about CAT, quote, "This has the same effect as ecstasy and cocaine and it's legal." Or before, starting this interview, I pulled up the drug fact sheet from the DEA's website. They asked the question, what's its effect on the mind? CAT, it says, can induce manic behavior with grandiose delusions, paranoia, nightmares, hallucinations, and hyperactivity. Chronic CAT abuse can result in violence and suicidal depression. And that's a DEA fact sheet that's up there today. Right. So you see this kind of, natural desire to kind of make CAT sound as if it's indistinguishable from the purified form of cathinone or even worse. Right. And just fit it in with the same kind of rhetoric that they use with respect to a bunch of other drugs, which have oftentimes much more powerful impact on human behavior.
That's right. I think this kind of conflation goes on so much with all drugs, obviously. But we talked earlier about the labeling of CAT as a drug and people kind of pushing back. So, for example, the Meru, who produce a lot of the CAT sold in Kenya and beyond, a lot of the CAT sold around the world. But they very much do push back against that idea of CAT as a drug. Like cocaine or the like, because they're aware of how that kind of idea is something that has restricted the trade and led to these kind of prohibitions and so forth.
There's an interesting thing that when you look at substances that are coming, if you look at kratom, coming from kratom, as it's called in Southeast Asia, coming into the West, and it's being used, oftentimes by, not emigre communities, but by people, a whole variety of people living, have long, go back multi-generations in the United States and other consuming countries. If you look at kava coming from South Pacific, once again, it's not just among South Pacific emigres. And I think that's true probably of a whole number of other sort of plant-based psychoactive substances. But with CAT, I don't see anything about it being used outside the emigre communities. I don't hear anything about, white people or black people or Hispanic people, that has taken this up. It just seems to be so powerfully connected to the cultural tradition that it's not breaking out. But is there any evidence that CAT is being used outside the emigre communities?
Very little, I think. Maybe some whites in places like the UK, who had experience, perhaps they'd been to Yemen and chewed some CAT there or Kenya, mm-hmm. and the like would perhaps chew. But it is something that really seems so very different to most of the sort of mainstream drug culture in somewhere like the UK, which does tend to revolve around substances that kind of do give you a more intense feeling. Or a quicker effect. I think for a lot of people, the thought of chewing a wad of CAT, chewing a wad of green leaves for hours on end is not something that is particularly appealing, beyond those communities where it's more traditionally associated. And I think one way that producers in Kenya, people like the Meru involved in the CAT industry, some of them have been quite forward thinking and realizing that the thought of chewing this substance for hours on end is not necessarily going to get them that, very, very much broader appeal than it has at the moment. So there has been development of things like kind of espresso shots of a CAT, kind of espresso pods that have been developed where, you know, the water will come through and still, I suppose that must probably be dried cat, but still does apparently produce the effects that people are looking for. And the other interesting thing there in Kenya is that there's a company that does make what's called handass juice. And handass is the main Kenyan term for the effects of the cat. You know, if you're feeling handass, you're feeling under the influence of a cat. And there is a company selling kind of like the equivalent of energy drinks, but produced from cat. So I think these are ways that people are trying to make it more appealing, you know, to a wider population.
Let's take a break here and go to an ad.
I bet you're smart.
Yeah, and you like to hold your own in the group chat.
We can help you drop even more knowledge. My name is Martine Powers.
And I'm Elahe Izadi. We host a daily news podcast called Post Reports.
Every weekday afternoon, Post Reports takes you inside an important and interesting story with the kind of reporting that you can only get from The Washington Post.
You can listen to Post Reports wherever you get your podcasts. Go find it now and hit follow.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
When it comes to financial advice, you gotta trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. If you're looking to upgrade your wallet, you need to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. If you're paying for vacations with whatever card is in your wallet, you could be missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. You can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet. Finance smarter.
You know, there's also that thing where you and your colleague at Bristol, Gernot Kleinschnick, who I also met in Abuja at the African Drugs Conference in October, you know, put forward this notion of quasi-legality and seeing that as a useful frame with which to think about cot and cannabis and possibly other substances. So just elaborate on that idea of quasi-legality.
Well, quasi-legality is our attempt really to get at these kind of legal ambiguities that we see as revolving around substances like cat and also cannabis in particular in various African and not just African, elsewhere in the world contexts. I'm really trying to get at the... So with, for example, cat, it always seemed like a substance that was often legal, like, for example, in Kenya for most of post-independence Kenyan history, cat has been legal. Yet until recently, cat had been seen as something to be held in suspicion, you know, partly because internationally it was seen as a substance to be suspicious of. And, you know, the substance that had been banned in various other parts of the world. And also the fact that cat, you know, it's kind of produced in these countries legally like Kenya and Ethiopia. But then when it travels into somewhere like Tanzania or other places, it does, you know, then enter into an illegal kind of framing. So really, we were trying to get at that kind of ambiguity of, you know, substances like cat, which aren't really, it's not very exactly clear kind of what their legal status is. And with cat, it was quite interesting, but it's often legal in places, you know, like Ethiopia and Kenya, yet often seen as being something kind of illegal. So according to the statute books, it's legal. Yet according to the way a lot of people in society view it, it's kind of is something that's conflated with these other illegal drugs, and therefore it takes on those connotations of being illegal. Whereas interestingly, with cannabis, it often seems to be the opposite. You know, cannabis in most African countries, so this is changing now with various policy changes in relation to cannabis in some African countries. But cannabis often seemed to be the opposite almost. It was usually by the statute books, it was illegal. Yet often it was seen as, you know, socially something that was very much tolerated or even supported. And I think these kind of terms get to that idea of the fact that what the statute books say, you know, doesn't necessarily take you very far into how a society views these kind of substances.
It's also interesting to see that when you're talking about kife being legal but sort of frowned upon, I mean, you tell the story about, for example, the government of Kenya was generally kind of negative about kife until the point where the United Kingdom criminalized it, and they criminalized it over the recommendations of their own advisory committee on drugs, which I think you had advised, saying don't criminalize it. And at that point, Kenya kind of jumps to the defense of kife and realizes it's got this economic value in parts of the country and realizes it's a significant source of, you know, tax revenue and export revenue for the government. So you see a kind of jumping forward to defend it. Yet on the other hand, I guess there are also issues. I mean, if you look with climate change, you look at a place like Yemen, you know, where issues around water and limited access to water and of large parts of agricultural land are actually being used to grow kot in places where you have a country in a major state of disruption, that could be problematic. You would think, and I think Axel Klein makes this point in some of his writings, that development agencies would in fact be embracing kot because it's an indigenously produced agricultural, you know, product market, something that has international ramifications, especially within the region. Yet they seem to stay away from it, where it's more lucrative than coffee and more reliable and lucrative than coffee and some other products that are usually exported to foreign markets and therefore provides a good, you know, constant source of revenue for farmers in the same way that those in Afghanistan benefit from opium and those in South America benefit from coca. It's a fascinating, it's a story that is unique in many respects compared to, I mean, similar in other places, but also it's got its own unique dynamics.
That's right. And I think it does bring out quite a lot of wider ambiguities in the world of drugs more generally. But the way it's kind of seen in terms of development, you know, is something that obviously there has been quite a lot of concern, especially in places like Ethiopia, of farmers, you know, kind of pulling up their coffee plants. You often hear of this and planting kat instead, you know, often the idea being like sort of, you know, coffee, given the very, very sort of limited funds and generally being marketed in particular ways where the farmers don't have particularly much control over it. Whereas kat, you know, given much more regular payments and more regular harvests and things like this, as well as being a more valuable crop. But I was always amused, probably about a decade ago now, reading an article that somebody wrote, an Irish guy who runs a coffee chain in Ireland, and he had travelled to Ethiopia, and he was horrified because in the area where some of the coffee was coming from for his chain, he was absolutely horrified to hear about these farmers, you know, pulling up coffee plants to plant kat instead. Kind of, but didn't quite see the contradiction of, you know, it's just these are both stimulants in a way, but you know, no, obviously there is like a hard and fast kind of economic logic to why these farmers are switching to or were at that time anyway switching to kat.
But what explains why it's more lucrative? I mean, if it's not illegal, usually what adds the price is the kind of prohibition tax, the, you know, the way in which making something criminal makes it much more valuable for those people who produce it, so long as they don't get caught by the law. But in the case of kat, right, it's relatively easy to produce, doesn't require a lot of care, yet it seems to sell for substantially more than most other agricultural products. Why is that?
That's a really good question. And I think you probably almost need to look at that in reverse. Like, why do the likes of coffee and tea fetch so little? And partly, I think it is to do with the, particularly in Kenya, the way the industry developed in relation to kat is very much more an informal way of way of operating the trade, and, you know, grew with, like you were saying, the Kenyan government for a long time was very hands off with CAT. They realized a lot of people depended on it, so they weren't going to prohibit it and move in that direction. But on the other hand, they didn't want to be seen to be encouraging it for much of Kenya's post-independence history. So really let the farmers get on with it. And I think the way it developed in this kind of way was a lot more on the terms of the people involved in its production and in its trade. And yes, it's, you know, there's always people who make more money in the commodity chain of obviously any agricultural commodity or any commodity more generally. But in general, I think not having that kind of corporate way of working that things like tea and coffee has, you know, with these smallholder farmers really, you know, getting very, very little for their product. Mm-hmm. You know, this is something that has helped CAT maintain its value.
Mm-hmm. Now, yeah, I realize now we didn't quite get deeply into the health aspects of CAT, right? I mean, you know, when you think about how relatively safe it is, what are the harms associated with it? I mean, what more can you tell us about, you know, the margins of risk and benefit from a health perspective about CAT chewing?
Yes. Oh, very important question. Yeah, in general, a lot of the research on the kind of health harms, because people much more often, I think, in research on CAT and other substances like this, focus on harms, don't they, rather than potential benefits of these kind of substances. You know, the way research might be framed. But there certainly are issues associated with it. In particular, for example, dental problems can be quite a big issue, particularly with people who chew cheaper varieties of CAT, which can be very bitter. So a lot. Often they're sweetening them with bubble gum or sugar, you know, and if you're not brushing your teeth kind of well after that, that can lead to issues. So sort of dental problems can be quite a big issue. And the probably the most alarming thing you hear about in relation to CAT, though, again, it's, you know, in terms of causality, as with all these things, it's very hard to pull apart. But you do hear people talk of a syndrome called CAT psychosis. Of, you know, people having psychotic episodes after consuming CAT. And there seems to be some evidence that CAT may have played a causal role in regard to this, though often seems to have been much more the case among people who had experienced, you know, high degrees of trauma. You know, perhaps in the Somali Civil War, or, you know, in kind of a refugee process. So how you sort of disaggregate CAT and issues of causality, you know, from these other wider factors that might make people more susceptible to psychosis is quite a difficult thing.
So, Neil, from a policy perspective, I mean, from everything we've talked about and from all my reading and preparing for our discussion, it seems to me that if one were making a policy recommendation, one would be saying, don't criminalize this stuff. There's no reason for countries around the world to be criminalizing it. And that the harms of criminalization probably exceed, you know, the benefits of criminalization, that the United Nations has been smart not to try to criminalize CAT or include it in the international anti-drug conventions, and that the UN agencies, the UNODC and the International Narcotics Control Board, the INCB, should, you know, just keep their hands off it and shut up, and that basically the risks of full legalization, even full global legalization, are pretty negligible given the relative sort of benefit-risk ratio of CAT use. Would you agree?
I think on the whole, yes, and It was quite a difficult issue, actually, for example, in the UK context with the ban that came in 2014, particularly as so much support for the ban was coming, especially mostly from Somalis within the UK. It was quite a thing, you know, when the community themselves, even people who did chew, a lot of them kind of argued that it should be banned. You know, this thing should be banned. So that was an aspect of the debates that is, you know, for for scholars and policymakers is quite an interesting, quite a difficult thing to deal with in some ways, you know, when it is coming from the community themselves. And my kind of perspective at the time of the UK ban was it was really an opportunity, I thought, for the UK government to try and bring in something, you know, some better policy towards CAT. So, for example, before CAT was banned, the British government was raising revenue on CAT imports, and it's, you know, seemed like potentially a way of dealing with a lot of the issues that the communities were concerned about in relation to CAT, you know, and wider issues facing communities like the Somalis in the UK, that maybe some of that tax revenue could be kind of hypothecated, you know, could have been put towards efforts to help those communities, or policies such as VAT, you know, that wouldn't have been a ban. Because what has effectively happened in the UK is that nobody's happy now, I think, other than the UK government, which has kind of kicked the issue of CAT into the long grass.
I'm gonna keep pushing you till you give me a straight answer here. I'm saying, if somebody asks you, Neil Carrier, what should we do about CAT? Should this stuff simply be legal around the world? It's got no business being a prohibited substance anywhere. Would you say yes, or would you say I don't know, or no?
I would generally say yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's good to push. I think where the sensitivities come, though, because it are those sensitivities of the, you know, so much of the calls for it to be banned coming from the communities themselves, you see.
But as you say, I mean, there's been such a history around the world where oftentimes, you know, people from indigenous communities or others will call for prohibitions, you know, not foreseeing all the ways in which those prohibitions will have radically negative consequences for their communities. So, you know, my view has been it's kind of incumbent on anybody who looks at this from both a policy perspective and a human rights perspective, you know, to look at it clearly and speak clearly, even if people from within those communities are divided about what the policy should be.
Yes. Yeah. No, that's a very fair point.
Well, I'll tell you, I want to thank you ever so much for having this conversation about CAT with me and my listeners on Psychoactive. As I said, I think it may be the first podcast ever, although maybe I missed one, on this issue of CAT. And hopefully we see policy doesn't seem to be changing very much anywhere in the world right now, but it, you know, it seems like it's not doing too much harm, although it could be better. But, Neil, thank you very much and best of luck. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. I was just going to make one final point that it's quite interesting, as well, you know, when we think about how drug policy does seem to be in flux quite a bit, substances are going in different directions. You know, cannabis around the world seeming to become more liberalized in various parts of the world, whereas CAT, you know, something most people, I think, would see as a milder substance, but, you know, it's becoming more and more illegal around the world. So I think CAT and cannabis do speak to a lot of the ambiguities of when you put those into comparison.
Well, with that, Neil, I want to thank you ever so much for having this conversation with me and my listeners on Psychoactive.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
If you're enjoying Psychoactive, please tell your friends about it. Or you can write us a review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. We love to hear from our listeners. If you'd like to share your own stories, comments, and ideas, then leave us a message at 1-833-779-2460. That's 833-PSYCHO-0. Or you can email us at psychoactive@protozoa.com or find me on Twitter at Ethan Nadelman. You can also find contact information in our show notes. Psychoactive is a production of iHeartRadio and Protozoa Pictures. It's hosted by me, Ethan Nadelman. It's produced by Noam Osband and Josh Thane. The executive producers are Dylan Golden, Ari Handel, Elizabeth Giesis, and Darren Aronofsky from Protozoa Pictures, Alex Williams and Matt Frederick from iHeartRadio, and me, Ethan Nadelman. Our music is by Ari Belusian, and a special thanks to Avivit Bar-Yosef, Bianca Grimshaw, and Robert Beebe. Next week, I'll be talking with Dennis McKenna, the famed ethnobotanist and anthropologist whose book, The Brotherhood of the Screaming Abyss, will soon be re-released.
Well, science fiction was a huge influence on us. you know, and it cultivated a fascination with the esoteric and the strange, you know. I mean, from our perspective, you know, we were weird, and the weirder the better, you know. And so when psychedelics came along, I think that we viewed it not from a context of spirituality or indigenous practices or anything like that. I mean, we discovered that later, but originally the idea was that, hey, these are other dimensions. Psychedelics can take you to other dimensions, and we thought of that quite literally.
Subscribe to Psychoactive now so you don't miss it.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the Star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.